Hi, I'm Dr. Robert Pearl, former CEO of the Permanente Medical Group, Kaiser Permanente, a Stanford Medical and Business School professor, a Forbes contributor and best-selling author of the book Mistreated, Why We Think We're Getting Good Healthcare and Why We're Usually Wrong.
And I am Jeremy Corr, host of the New Books in Medicine podcast. American healthcare is broken. Across the United States, there are over 200,000 patient deaths from medical error every year, growing physician burnout, outdated technology, and inconvenient and delayed care for patients. And on top of all of this, skyrocketing drug prices and increasingly unaffordable out-of-pocket patient expenses. For decades, our nation's political and medical leaders have talked about fixing the American healthcare system, and yet the problems are now greater than in the past.
Every other industry that is inefficient and ineffective has experienced disruption. Healthcare will be no different. The question is whether the solutions will come from inside the healthcare system or be imposed on it. We'd like to invite you to listen to our new podcast, Fixing Healthcare with Dr. Robert Pearl and Jeremy Corr. Each episode will feature one of the top leaders and innovative thinkers in healthcare today. The show's format is simple. The guests will present a roadmap for fixing American healthcare's biggest problems. And from there, Jeremy and I will scrutinize the plan and help listeners separate fixes that have the potential to succeed from simply the hype.
Our goal is that everyone from healthcare consumers to political and medical leaders will find value in the discussions on our show. You may not agree with the different solutions offered, but you will never again conclude that nothing can be done. We hope you will join us. Please subscribe via iTunes or your favorite podcast software. For more information, visit our website at www.fixinghealthcarepodcast.com. Somewhere out there is a dangerous virus that is boiling up in the bloodstream of a bird, bat, monkey, or pig, preparing to jump to a human being. It's hard to comprehend the scope of such a threat, for it has the potential to wipe out millions of us, including my family and yours, over a matter of weeks or months. The risk makes the threat posed by ISIS, a ground war, a massive climate event, or even the dropping of a nuclear bomb on a major city pale by comparison. Hello and welcome to the New Books in Medicine podcast. I am your host, Jeremy Corr. That was an excerpt from the new book, The End of Epidemics, The Looming Threat to Humanity and How to Stop It. I have with me today the author of that book, the world-renowned epidemiologist and public health expert, Dr. Jonathan Quick. Dr. Jonathan Quick, welcome to the show.
Thank you, Jeremy. Good to be here.
Jonathan, can you start by telling the listeners a little bit about yourself and how you ended up where you are today?
Well, I'm a family physician by training, and after practicing in the U.S. Public Health Service in Oklahoma, delivering babies and taking care of gunshot wounds and snake bites, I decided I really liked having whole countries as patients. So I went into global health, worked initially in the pharmaceuticals area, joined a nonprofit, Management Sciences for Health, where I lived and worked in Pakistan, in Kenya. I spent 10 years with the World Health Organization, and then have just finished a decade as the CEO of Management Sciences for Health. So it's been a life for my family and me, where I've gotten around to about 70 countries and pretty much all of the continents except Antarctica.
Okay. I want to give our listeners a quick little frame of reference for the rest of the show. Can you please explain the difference between an outbreak, an epidemic, and a pandemic?
Yes. So an epidemic is actually a general term, which means the occurrence in a community or region of illness that's beyond what you normally expect. And so it really applies to large and small events. An outbreak is indeed a localized epidemic, where in a town or village or a country you get an increase in a disease. Pandemic is an epidemic, an unusually large number of cases, but over a wide area, crossing international boundaries, nor usually affecting a large number of people, and often causing severe disease in, at as I say, across borders. And we often think of a pandemic as something that goes global.
Let's talk a little bit about some of the recent major epidemics, SARS, Ebola, and HIV. How did they spread, and what was their impact?
Well, each of those is new over the last 100 years, and they exemplify the fact that 3 out of 4 new human diseases, infectious diseases, come from a animal-to-human species jump. HIV, actually, the AIDS virus, actually made that jump in the 1920s in southeast Cameroon. Worked its way with, probably through bushmeat, through eating monkeys. It was originally a monkey virus, a simian virus. And the virus made 5 jumps into humans before it made a successful one. Worked its way down to the Congo, and from there, with some guest workers that had been there from Haiti under the Belgian colonial government and who took it back to Haiti, it went global. So AIDS was the first new human pandemic disease in modern times. It actually took from 1920 till 1980 until it really exploded in the world's awareness. Ebola was a virus from East Africa, and it the first outbreak was several decades ago. There had been over 20 outbreaks of Ebola over the years between its discovery and in the 2014 West Africa outbreak, and those were all taken care of fairly quickly with less than a few hundred cases. Ebola is a virus that typically is the reservoir, the place where it's kind of held in nature is bats, and when humans come in contact with bat excretion or eating bats as a bushmeat, that's how you get it. So that was that got out of control in West Africa for a variety of reasons that we can talk about. SARS was actually the first new pandemic of the 21st century. 2003, a totally unknown virus appeared in China. A Chinese businessman carried it from rural China. No virus that was in a bat got transmitted to a food delicacy animal called a civet, was eaten, and that virus was carried by this traveler to the ninth floor of the Metropolitan Hotel in Hong Kong, and from there it spread in a matter of weeks to 27 countries. SARS is a good example of what happens when you do everything right, because this previously unknown virus, for which we had no diagnosis, no medicine, no treatment, with rapid, decisive public health action, was put back in the box in 6 months and hasn't had an outbreak of significance since then. So three examples of new pathogens that are in nature, new viruses that make a animal to human jump and then cause a major disease outbreak, which eventually, in the case of AIDS, became a horrific global pandemic.
Now, I'd like for you to talk about the big one, the 1918 Spanish flu. Can you tell us how bad was it? How and why did it get so bad? And what were some of the failures that caused it to get so bad?
Well, this is an interesting flu virus. Most of the flu seems to come out of Asia. This is one wherever it originated, it got started actually in Kansas and was carried by troops initially from Fort there to Europe, and from Europe, this was right at the end of World War One, right in the final months of World War One, this flu virus got started, went to Europe, and from there went global. In the end, over a two-year period, it killed 5,200 million people, infected a large share of the world's population, had a huge knock on the global economy. And I think there were a variety of factors that made it so deadly. One was the wide variation in public health systems and response. So the U.S. had already pretty good public health measures. We had by then eradicated smallpox in the U.S. with good public health response. And even within the U.S., we had a twofold difference between different cities on the in the mortality rate. New York responded quickly and decisively, isolated those who were infected and canceled major events. Pittsburgh, which acted slowly, was hit a lot harder. And globally, a lot of countries just didn't have the sort of response mechanism and prevention mechanisms that we had. It was also hitting a population that had been war ravaged and suffered from malnutrition. So there were a variety of factors. The other factor was that it was a virus, and this is key for flu pandemics. It was a virus that was a new flu virus. It was highly deadly, highly contagious because we didn't have any immunity. It wasn't a flu virus that we had seen in decades. So we didn't have immunity. And the second thing is that it was a strain that was particularly deadly with people in the 20 to 50 age range. So there were a variety of factors that made it both very contagious and very deadly.
I know when I was reading the portion of the book about the Spanish flu, I was thinking the same thing that a lot of the listeners probably are right now. That was 100 years ago. Technology and healthcare both come so far since then. Is it even possible for an epidemic to get that bad now?
I'm afraid so. For one thing, the flu virus is just as wily, just as mercurial. And we have the nature of the flu virus is it travels in packs. It's not just one virus. Typically, in a flu season, there are three or four. It's constantly mutating and also trading genes with each other. So you'll have avian flu genes, swine flu genes, human flu genes that are mixing and matching, and then you've got the fact that it's a more primitive kind of genetic material, RNA as opposed to DNA. So it doesn't self-correct or self-edit some of its mutations. What is really worrisome in terms of the flu virus is that we are constantly seeing these outbreaks, particularly of avian flu, which has mortality rates when it gets to humans of often 50%. Now, we've been really fortunate in that these have not caused widespread human outbreaks because they haven't been able to replicate and cause a sort of human-to-human transition that will cause a pandemic. But we're really at risk of that. And with 19 billion chickens on the planet, they really become pandemic incubators. So potential pandemic incubators, and certainly incubators of serious outbreaks in poultry, which that mutation, and some experts say we're only a couple mutations away from that that H5N1 highly pathogenic chicken virus becoming infectious in among humans. So that's one factor. The other factor is that flu, people say, well, we have antibiotics now, and flu actually kills mostly by the pneumonia it causes, which is true. But we are getting more and more antimicrobial resistance. And when we look at the health systems worldwide, they're not as prepared. But the bigger thing is we are twice as urban as we were 100 years ago. We're four times the population, and we're 50 times more mobile. So the potential to spread is dramatic.
In the book, you know, a lot of the experts you mentioned say that the question isn't if, but when the next major global pandemic will occur. How likely do you think a pandemic on that scale is? And what would you consider the worst case scenario to be in terms of death toll as well as social and economic impact?
We tend to get influenza pandemics at a cycle of and it varies, you know, typically maybe every four decades, when we have a huge share of the population that doesn't have any natural immunity, and we don't predict well on the vaccine, so we're really at risk, and I think that could happen any time now. I think when you run a scenario, and the Bill Gates has run a scenario that takes a conservative scenario, within 100 days the death toll would be 750,000 people. That's like a really bad flu year. Within 100 days, 750,000 people. Within 200 days, it would be 33 million people because of this exponential impact of the spread. If we had a virus like 1918 and we had the same rate of infection and mortality rate, it would be 200 to 400 million people. And that's not out of the question. The other factor is that it's not just the pneumonia that kills people, which, provided we're not having a resistant pneumonia, can be treated. There's also a reaction that is more common, appears to be more common in the 20 to 50 age range, which is an over-response to the immune system, something called a cytokine storm or C-storm. And that needs an intensive care unit to be treated. And we don't have enough intensive care units. So there are a number of factors that make the potential impact really dramatic.
Where do you think this next epidemic could come from? What are some of the likely sources?
We need to be realistic that it could appear anywhere. So, for example, most of the flu viruses tend to come from Asia, but as I've pointed out, the 1918 flu actually got started in Kansas. The 2009 got started in Mexico and California, the swine flu of 2009, and so the virus itself, because flu viruses are kind of on the move, may have originated someplace else, but the actual outbreak and the start of it could come really in Latin America, as we saw with the explosion of Zika. It could come from Africa, as we have seen with Ebola, and as we now know, AIDS. It could come from Asia. So it really could appear anywhere. And the thing that is really disturbing is that only one out of three countries worldwide have the ability to rapidly detect and respond. So we have lots of places around the world where these viruses could get started and would not be detected. And that's when it's really, really dangerous. I mentioned the SARS virus. The 2003 first pandemic of this, the potential pandemic of this century, that was probably a couple of plane flights away from getting into Africa or parts of Asia where the response wasn't good, and that wouldn't have been good, and that could still be with us today. So we are vulnerable, and it really could come from anywhere.
Now, one of the things you talk about in the book is bioterror and bioerror, as well as, you know, factory farms, and these being, you know, some of the likely scenarios that a new, you know, epidemic could come from. It's crazy to me. I felt like I could not necessarily relate, but understood, you know, the factory farming portion of it. I grew up in rural Iowa, and the hog confinements, the factory farming is everywhere. You can't drive more than 5 minutes, and the smell is something from those that you'll never forget if you've ever been close to one. And the crazy thing about them is they're, you know, a lot of people when I travel from, you know, from big cities think of, you know, they think of the Midwest as your traditional family farm. It's not that way anymore. They're almost all factory farms.
Yeah, indeed. And factory farm, well, Well-managed, well-regulated factory farms are probably a relatively low risk, but they don't. But that's the consistency and the level of care, because the key thing is if you've got poultry or you've got swine that are basically sharing the same air as people handling them, that's where you get the risk of spread. It's also a problem in terms of the development of antimicrobial resistance. So we talk about the bush, the barn, and the bioterrorist. The bush we've really talked about, and that is these dumps that come from animals, from monkeys or bats or other animals. And the barn, of course, is the factory farms and even small-scale farms you can get. Bioterror is really concerning because the availability of technology now is such that you could pretty much make a smallpox virus from scratch, and we know from computers seized from ISIS terrorists, they have full-fledged plans and can describe in very, very clear detail how they would infect a major population center with anthrax, with other sorts of pandemic viruses. We know that the South Korean Department of Defense believes that North Korea has capability. They have in their possession 12 pandemic viruses, including smallpox and anthrax. They, to our knowledge, have not started weaponizing them, but their track record in weaponizing when they decide to is very disturbing. So this is a significant threat. Let me say something about bioerror, and that is there are labs that are developing superbugs, viruses that they develop highly pathogenic viruses and study how to develop vaccines against these viruses. And they have high levels of security, but we have scores of examples of high-level security labs who have accidentally sent anthrax, a U.S. Army lab accidentally sent anthrax to several states and several countries. So these are concerns that warrant a lot of careful oversight to be sure that we don't become the victims of bioerror.
You know, I'll be honest with you when I say that I found the beginning part of your book to be pretty terrifying. I was actually reading it on an airplane when I was traveling, which is literally probably the worst place to read a book of this subject matter, considering, you know, how germ-filled airports and airplanes are. I was actually at a conference and I had a colleague text me on her way home and say, "Jeremy, the kid in front of me on the airplane is coughing so hard he's gagging. I feel bad for him, but all I can think about is that book you were telling me about that you're reading." Diseases and epidemics are scary stuff, but your book and what I liked about it the most was that it's a book of hope. You put together an action plan that you call the Power of Seven that's meant to literally end epidemics. What's the concept behind it, and what are the seven actions?
So one point on the end of epidemics. So I want to be clear. There always are going to be local disease outbreaks. So epidemics with a small e, and that's just nature. The bugs will always be there. What I believe that we could do is make the world much, much safer for these really catastrophic epidemics and pandemics like what we've seen with AIDS, with Zika as it spread, and with influenza. So we stepped back and we looked at 100 years of pandemics and said, what have we learned? And what are the big levers to really prevent and effectively respond? And it really comes down to this power of seven. Number one is leadership, decisive leadership that gets the plot. I mean, during World War I, President Wilson refused to acknowledge the influenza epidemic. despite appeals from the head medical officer with the U.S. military and his own personal doctor, and probably contributed to that epidemic. SARS is an example where we had decisive action on the part of the World Health Organization. The Director General of the World Health Organization, Dr. Gro Brundtland, had been Prime Minister of Norway at a young age, ran the environment work for the UN, and came into the World Health Organization, was convinced by the infectious disease people to build a good response system, and acted decisively and stopped SARS in its tracks. Whereas we saw with Ebola that there was really a delay and not that sort of decisiveness, and that's where what could have been a small and rapidly contained outbreak really took off. So decisive leadership is number one. The second thing is basic strong health systems, the ability to prevent, detect, and respond in every country. We're not talking about every country having, you know, high-tech top-end labs, but having the basics of being able to prevent and respond and detect. And that's a matter of training, and it's a matter of mobilizing at all levels so that community health workers on up. The third thing is the active prevention, immunization programs. In this country, only about half of people at risk for influenza are getting the influenza vaccine. And so this kind of awareness of prevention is really critical.
I would say one thing I wanted to ask you here, I think now is a decent time to ask you, but, you know, in your book, you call vaccines our most powerful protection. Jonas Salk, for example, he literally reached celebrity status for his work with polio vaccine, for his work on the polio vaccine and the impact it had. I want to know, what is your message to the modern and very vocal, especially on social media, anti-vaccine movement in the U.S.?
Well, it's interesting. That takes actually to the fourth area, which we call timely truths and fatal fictions. So every mother wants the best for their child. And that I understand. And they don't want a child with autism. But we really have to, from the earliest ages in education, get people to understand how to separate truth from fiction. And the person who started that, the vaccine autism myth, Andrew Wakefield, that article was published 20 years ago last month. We've actually written about this. He is still active. And actually, the most recent measles outbreak in Europe, which Europe, like the U.S., was on the way to eliminating measles. They had over 20,000 cases last year. And when we look at the footprint of the work of Andrew Wakefield and his ideas in the media there is a direct relation to the fall in vaccine and immunization. So there are a couple of things that are important there. One is, and California has demonstrated this, with their response to measles outbreaks there, we really do need some basic good public health regulations and laws. We also need to help people, mothers, to understand that the benefits of vaccine and to address some of the myths, but also we need to continue the research on autism and say, communicate more about what is causing autism and what we've learned about what the causes are, and finally we've learned that, and this is really critical, the messenger can be much more important than the message. So if I hold a belief really dearly and closely, and you try to convince me with facts, I'll just hold on to that belief more closely. It's called the backfire effect. So what you need is people who are trusted. The story about Ebola in West Africa that we've heard in the West is mostly a story of failure, health systems that were a mess and everything else. The story that isn't told is how quickly once the people in the communities understood Ebola, how quickly the outbreak ended. It was very impressive. And the way they did it, we tell a story in the end of Epidemics from Sierra Leone where they weren't doing well with just the facts on the radio and all that. When they went and talked to the religious leaders, the 4,000 market women, the traditional healers, and others in the community, they got the message, they were trusted, and they sent the message out, and behaviors changed rapidly. So that's the fourth. That communication area is the fourth part of the Power of Seven. The fifth is innovation, and we identify five game-changing innovations. One of the most important ones is the flu vaccine. The Jonas Salk also was developed. The first flu vaccine was part of developing the first flu vaccine. That's where he got the experience that led him to develop polio. And it was 1938. It was 80 years ago. We're still making flu vaccine basically the same trial and error way and growing it the same slow chicken egg way as we were 80 years ago. And so we are just now, in the last really 5 years, working to get a much better flu vaccine and to produce it in a much better way. But we need some innovations in terms of vaccines, medicines, diagnostics, early warning systems. So that's number five. Number six is we've got to invest. There is a cycle where when we have a SARS or an avian flu or a swine flu or an Ebola, lots of promises are made for funding and everything else. But when you go back a few years down the line, we have health services that have been any research programs that have been defunded, destaffed. It's this complacency. We go between panic and neglect. So we need to keep up the investment. It's not a big investment in the scheme of things. It amounts to $1 per person per year extra for the next couple of decades. $7.5 billion a year, with the largest share of that goes for building the health systems, the epidemic response capability in countries, and then a share of investment in a pretty modest share for rapid emergency response.
I would say in your book, you talk about, you know, just how bad an epidemic can be for the economy in terms of, you know, both cost to, you know, to deal with it, as well as how much it can disrupt the economy. Can you talk about that versus the expense spent on the preventative work?
Yes. It's there's this epidemic cascade where we have the direct impact of an outbreak or a pandemic, and then the avoidance behavior. So that together has a huge impact on the health system. In the U.S., we could have 3 or 4 million people turned away in a severe pandemic. We also saw with Ebola is almost as many deaths from AIDS, TB, malaria, because the health system wasn't working. Kids out of school. Businesses lose. Mexico lost $5 billion in tourism with SARS in Asia. Companies were put out of business. And so it's the worst case scenario is a hit of $3.5 trillion to the global economy, which is about what the Great Recession was in 2008. And that puts millions of people out of work, and it has a huge health impact. So it's both the economics and then the human impact of these epidemics. So that leads. So that investment is critical, and I think that it's critical. It's both public and private. And then the seventh element is advocacy. One of the things that we learned from AIDS is that it really took a committed group of advocates to keep ringing the alarm on the outbreak. And one of the questions I asked Dr. Brundtland, the WHO Director General that mounted the SARS response, was what made her decide to build the infectious disease response system What made her decide to invest in that? And she said, they made the case. The infectious disease people made the case. She said, look, a lot of people, when you're in a position of leadership, everybody comes to you with their asks. And the difference in terms of investing in infectious disease preparedness with WHO is that they made the case. So what we need to do as citizens, as health professionals, as researchers, is we need to keep making the case over and over again for the importance of the investment. We're in a situation in March of 2018 where we have just invested, the governments and foundations of the world just invested over 5 years in a significant program to increase the responsiveness and ability of countries in epidemic prevention and preparedness. And now we're talking within the U.S. about pulling back our funding on that, which is really just madness, in the sense that there's no question that it will cost more in human lives and economically to stop this effort in building prevention than to keep putting a fairly amounts to really a fairly modest amount of investment in. So we need to keep the alarm sounded. One of our partners in with a book is a group called Global Citizens. The End of Epidemics website has links to them. There are other advocacy groups, so One Campaign and Trust for America's Health that really are good sources of data and information. So that's number seven is advocacy and really keeping the awareness so that all of the things that need to happen continue to happen between the headline grabbing outbreaks.
Right. So, you mentioned those headline grabbing outbreaks. One of my concerns is similar to the way, we view terrorism, where, if 50 of them are prevented and stopped, no one knows, no one cares. That doesn't get the headlines. But, when one does, it's devastating. The fingers point, and that's when people really buy in and care, not on the downtimes.
Well, yes. And those become teachable moments. And that's why we've made a point of trying to take the lessons and the current experience with this year's flu outbreak, this year's flu epidemic, to write in Time magazine about our flu complacency killing us, and in the Wall Street Journal about an action plan. And so I think we do need to when these events, which are horrific at the time, happen with Ebola or with Zika or with the annual severe flu outbreaks, we need to remind people that this is the reality that we face if we don't keep going on the process of developing the tools that we need to prevent and respond.
Now, one of the things I want to talk to you about a little bit is in your book, you talk about social media being essentially a double-edged sword in terms of, the spread of misinformation, but it can also be used as a tool for good. Can you elaborate on that a little bit?
On the hand, we saw back with Ebola, and we've seen evidence again now that people will trust social media and they'll believe frank falsehoods on social media before they believe official sources. That's really, really problematic. At the same time, social media gives us a window into what people are thinking and what the false beliefs are. So good communication is both getting the correct information out and believed and countering the unhelpful beliefs or in fact, dangerous beliefs. So during the West Africa outbreak, for example, with Ebola, Nigeria and others used the social media to understand what people were believing and then to provide the counter information. And so that's really part of double-edged sword. In order to get the maximum benefit and minimize the adverse effects, we need, as I said earlier, we need to begin at an early age to help people to understand how you ferret out the truth from all of these statements and unfounded advice that people give.
Just to tell a good story, can you tell us a little bit about Ethiopia's fight against AIDS?
Well, Ethiopia is one of the poorest countries. They set out, the former minister of health there, Dr. Tedros, who's now director general of the World Health Organization, he really set out a vision for covering the whole country with extension workers and a vision of universal coverage of basic health care. So that was the foundation. And then with at the time back in the mid 2000s, up until the kind of 2005 up to 2009, AIDS prevention and treatment, particularly treatment, tended to be hospital based. And what Ethiopia said, with the support of U.S. government, and we were fortunate in Management Sciences for Health to help, is to envision a community based prevention and treatment. So when you medicalize these infectious diseases and have it hospital oriented and doctor oriented, you can't be effective. You have to get out into the community. And what we found was by taking prevention and treatment closer to the community, the adherence to treatment was better. And we have learned that treatment is prevention. And it also enlisted HIV positive volunteers, community outreach workers, to really carry the message. So it was a whole of society response that brought in those that were affected in a very positive way.
What will the ideal future be if we as humankind buy into and act on your power of seven? And how realistic do you think it is that we can end, these major epidemics?
I think that we certainly can make tremendous progress in reducing the odds of a major pandemic and really catastrophic pandemics. The first thing is building the capability of each country to see a new disease outbreak, ask the question, this isn't normal, rapidly respond. And we know that basic public health responses, even without a vaccine, without medicine, without high tech, identifying and isolating quickly, that alone will control, and actually every year does control, hundreds of outbreaks. So that's number one. It could be really effective. The second thing is to have a population that's really educated in good health practices and all. And if we really invest in a better flu vaccine, if we invest in vaccine technologies for the World Health Organization has a list of about 8 target viruses that we really need to develop vaccines against. It would take a couple of decades, but if we work in all of these areas, we can first of all eradicate some of the diseases, eliminate some of the diseases that we have, like measles, AIDS, and all. So I'm confident that we can make the world substantially safer if we really keep on the investment, the innovation, education of the public, and the basic health systems that we need.
And I'll say, I love your book. What are some of the big things that, people like me and our listeners, your average everyday citizen, what can we do to help you with the power of seven? And how can we, what can we do to help you with this whole process?
Well, so it's really helping yourselves and your communities. I think, first of all, to recognize that we're all vulnerable. We are not in a world that is free of these diseases. And even if we have been fortunate to have good health, we've seen this year weightlifters, marathoners, people who thought they were in good health end up dying from the flu. I had a colleague whose 6-year-old son, classmate, died of flu. Healthy kid. So I think recognizing, being humble about it, that we're all at risk. And then one is within your own communities, within your schools, within your place of work and all, ask the question, are we prepared? So are we at least once a year having some sort of an exercise where we're at least reminding ourselves what is our response plan for major outbreaks and a major flu or worse, and for health facilities, are we have we thought through how to handle the surge and updated our process? So that's one, is making it personal. The second is with your state budgets and with the national budgets. I mean, track and through Trust for America's Health or through One Campaign or through others, let your congressman know that you support the investment. There are bills in Congress to fully fund developing a universal flu vaccine, and it's a very much investment. So that's the second part of it. And also, look in on Global Citizen. Go to globalcitizen.org and see what they're up to, trying to push the country, the G20, the leaders of the large countries around the world to keep their promises, because there have been enough promises made to fight pandemics. It's keeping those promises that's really important.
Well, Dr. Quick, I've taken up enough of your time today. I do want to ask you the traditional final question. What are you working on now?
So at this point, the next thing for me is to keep ringing the bell on the threat of pandemics. I think it's clear that the threat is real and significant. The scientific and public health community knows what to do. They know what's needed, but we're moving too slowly with too few resources. So I will continue to do interviews, to write, and to promote these ideas here and in Europe and in Asia and throughout the world, because I think we're at risk and we can make a world that's safer for ourselves, our children, and our children's children.
All right, perfect. Well, I'd love to have you back on the show and stay in touch with you. Thank you for your time today and have a great day.
Okay, thank you, Jeremy.